Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss trauma. Now, of course, barely an episode goes by where we don't mention trauma. As clinical experience and research progresses, we're finding that trauma is associated with many of the ways that we struggle as human beings psychologically. In this episode, we define trauma generally, discuss how traumatic experiences can lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, explore a few ways trauma can be treated effectively, review polyvagal theory, and of course, much, much more. Reed and I get asked by helping professionals all the time where they can get good training on how to use psychedelic tools in clinical practice. Well, Numinous has several psychedelic therapy training programs on offer. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection. And you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. Well, if you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes as well, or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. Of course, if you'd like to support our show, as always, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you so much to those of you who have done that already. We read all those reviews, and they just make me feel really good about myself. So thank you. Without further ado, here's our conversation on trauma. Well, welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. How are you doing, Reed?
Pretty well. Pretty well. Can't complain. How about you, Steve?
Well, if you can tell in my voice, I'm on the tail end of a cold. Thankfully, the tail end.
How do you know it's the tail end?
Faith.
Yeah. Faith.
That's my hope.
Yeah.
I've had it for long enough, and it's not as bad as it was. So that's my best guess, not being a physician myself.
Infectious disease curves from the CDC, perhaps.
Ups and downs. So, but the show must go on. So I'm gonna muster all the energy that I can. And today we thought we would take a brief sojourn into the world of trauma. We of course talk a lot about trauma on the show. It's almost like there is an episode that goes by that we don't talk a little bit about trauma. And I think over a year ago, when we had Devin Christie on, we talked about trauma a little bit, and we've talked about it periodically, but we thought it just might be interesting to dive into it topically, see what we can dredge up and share with y'all.
Yeah, I like it. And while we're on the topic, or before we leave fully the topic of germs, it brings up like a little bit of an analogy in that when we're fighting off an infection, as long as it doesn't kill you, it's making you stronger in some ways. Like assuming you have the resources to the machinery inside, the resources in and around you to battle that, to recover from that, then you end up with a stronger immune system and maybe learn some things along the way, perhaps.
Man, what a great tie-in. Maybe Nietzsche was right. Like what doesn't kill you can make you stronger. But I do want to...
I thought that was Kanye.
Might have been. Yeah. Maybe Kanye got it from Nietzsche. But I do know I've been part of some conversations where that notion, this idea of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, applied to the to traumatic events in one's life, can feel a little what's the right word? Like invalidating or not correct to a lot of people's experience, right? Especially people who've experienced a lot of trauma.
You'd never wish that on yourself or anyone. Yeah.
Or, saying to somebody who is struggling with just this legacy of crap that's happened to them,
like, you'll be stronger.
Yeah. Shouldn't you be stronger because of this? It's really just your attitude. If you had changed your attitude, then maybe you would have been stronger instead of completely immobilized by your trauma. That's certainly not what we're saying, right? But human beings are adaptation machines. And I'll meet your metaphor and raise you another. Sometimes I like to think about this in terms of physical exercise, right? When we're lifting weights, for example, or doing physical therapy on a joint, we are providing a stimulus that can be kind of overwhelming for the muscle, so much so that it actually tears muscle fibers. And it's the body's reaction to that stress or that quote unquote trauma that leads to strength. so that you can then meet that resistance if you see it again in the form of an exercise with more capacity.
Yeah, that's why we say and use that mantra sometimes, seek discomfort. Yeah. Yeah, and it ties into this idea of, that I think is highly relevant, of window of tolerance, that is your optimal zone for functioning within the world when you're not either, your nervous system is not over-aroused, hyper-aroused into, say, fight or flight, or when it's not hypo-aroused into, like, immobility, curled up in a ball, freeze. Yeah. And that window can be expanded through practice and life experiences, and we learn ways of pulling ourselves back from outside the window or from the edges of it as we do this work on both recognizing the signs and what's going on inside and learning and trying on things that help us regulate.
Yeah. So that window of tolerance idea might be a good way to approach defining trauma. And we'll go on to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, the actual psychiatric condition. But I guess one way to think about what a trauma is, one that leads to symptoms afterward, is something that happens to you, something distressing, something really, really scary, or perhaps life-threatening, or the actual presence of something that harms you physically or psychologically that is outside your window of tolerance, right? That you don't have the psychological, the social, the physiological resources to cope with. And so the nervous system does go way into fight or flight. It goes way down into freeze. And as a result, without feeling safe in that moment, the arousal, like the autonomic arousal and all the associated cognitions and everything, emotions, persist in time. After the trauma itself, the traumatic event or the series of events has passed.
Yeah. Like in the face of trauma and stress, you know, we literally like constrict our body and our mind tightens in some ways too. There's a response, and that can become kind of tonic and then chronic. You know, you can get stuck in those places if it becomes repeated and we don't have ways of getting out of it or releasing that tension. But yeah, I like the framework you're starting us with, is that trauma isn't just the event. It's what happens next. It's like it's a nervous system event, essentially, and your inability to, or ability to, process it at the time with the resources you have.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes the word trauma is used as a noun, like that was a trauma, or an adjective, like that was traumatic. And people, you will hear people talk about, like my trauma, that thing that happened to me when I was young, or that thing that happened even just, you know, 6 weeks ago, that's my trauma. And they'll make reference to their trauma as a way to explain the ways that they react to certain stimuli now, or the ways that they behave in their social environment, or the ways that they feel intrapsychically. So they attribute these changes to a thing that has happened to them. So like a sentinel event, or what we call it, like an index trauma.
Yeah,
is often what
that's
referred
what we
to.
Use in the research world. You know, you find that index event. And then even though there could be, and often are, multiple, but as a starting place.
Right. Yeah. So you have this event, and it is, like I said before, it was super dangerous, or at least you could, even by current definitions of post-traumatic stress disorder, you can hear about a traumatic event that happened to a loved one or somebody you care about. They do in the DSM-5 now make this distinction, like this does not count if you were watching news about September 11th, like at least according to the DSM, any kind of emotional sequela that you experience as a result of like watching news about horrifying things doesn't necessarily count toward the diagnosis of PTSD. It's interesting. I mean, I think that questions could probably be debated.
Yeah, we could, that'd be a fun rabbit hole to go down, but that we don't have time for or the purpose for, perhaps, but it's an interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah. But so there needs to be a trauma present, right? This index trauma, like you said, a single event or multiple events.
Yeah. And what's interesting is what, like we were saying, what happens next, or the disconnection from self that occurs in order to survive, and the protections we mount as barriers to like survive that and prevent the re-experiencing of overwhelming pain.
And I like the way you phrased it, you know, describing these, what in the DSM would be called symptoms or symptom clusters, as protections, like as ways mm-hmm. that we respond when otherwise healthy ways or more, I don't know, adaptive ways are not available to us for whatever reason.
Yeah. From the IFS work, you know, we've all been doing, and from the training deep dives I did last year and this year, I realized that protectors get a bad rap mm-hmm. in kind of our day-to-day life, or when we think about these responses we have, understandably, because when, say, a firefighter type of protector using IFS language kind of responds to a trigger and comes unhinged and blasts a fire hose to get anything that might bring that pain back far from you, that can be dramatic, that can cause some consequences in your day-to-day life, but it is so helpful to remember that those protectors are there for you, and they developed for a reason at the time
right.
when you needed those. And now the work lies in kind of shining a light of awareness on that, and kind of lovingly guiding your team of that symphony of selves into new roles and mm-hmm. and things that are more appropriate for the situation at hand and your resources now.
Yeah. It's been such a game changer for a lot of my clients to view those protectors as, you know, like you described them, as they're, because they're trying to meet a specific need. And in this case, to protect you from something, even if that something is, you know, the emotions that you would be better off if you were feeling, you know, to look at one's relationship to alcohol, for example,
yeah.
and be grateful. Like that's mm-hmm. really, I mean, it almost seems counterintuitive. Like, oh, I'm grateful for my tendency to overconsume alcohol. Not grateful in the sense that you want to keep doing it, but to start there from this no bad parts perspective.
Yeah.
You can, in my opinion, I've seen it a lot with my clients. You can make more progress that way when you approach them with that kind of understanding.
And those things often showed up to protect us from something much worse because we had limited options at the time, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah. But it's from a parts work and window of tolerance question, I mean, standpoint, I think it's also interesting to point out that the protectors are still going to have a voice when you're within your window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. Like coming unhinged and a firefighter coming on board and dramatically doing something to keep the pain far away, that might be outside of your window of tolerance, but in that window, you're still very likely going to have protector parts talking to you or using their voice, and hopefully the other ones, like some self-energy on board to help balance that. So within that window, you can decide how you respond to the road rage or whatever it may be.
And I think that sense of agency, what you said, that you can decide how you respond, is really a good flag for healing. Meaning that if you can move into agency, into volition, from what people typically experience when they're in the throes of PTSD, for example, this experience of being helpless in the face of their triggered responses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people will talk about a trauma response, like I said a second ago, and they have the experience, the real lived experience of just being like a light switch. It's not even a fuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even a short fuse to their angry outburst. It's just like, boom. I saw that a lot in my military veteran clients, you know, and active duty clients when I was in the Air Force.
Yeah, but
just flying off the handle at what seemed like the smallest provocation. And then, of course, as they view it retrospectively, they feel a ton of shame, a ton of guilt, but at a loss for what to do. Like it literally just happens. And I'm sometimes even completely dissociated during those times.
Mm-hmm. This is where I think polyvagal theory, as a kind of simplified framework of the complex machinery that is our wiring and our bodies and how we process all this stuff in life, by Stephen Porges and colleagues, I think is really useful because, I mean, just to try and break it down simply, we've talked about this window of tolerance, right? Where it's your optimal zone where you can stay somewhat regulated in your emotions and stay thinking clearly. And as you move towards the edge of that window, certain things happen in our bodies, our nervous systems, like heart racing, and systems start to come on board like they will in a big way in full-blown fight or flight. But you can start to recognize that earlier. And if you're in fight or flight mode, it also makes sense that the tools and practices that will bring you back would be more the soothing, grounding, calming ones. But on the other side of the window, below your window, is this immobilized state that we were talking about. And, you know, where you're kind of frozen or curled up in a ball, or maybe you just check out, you're like dissociate or withdraw from the world, where in your window, you're engaged and connecting and feeling safe. In either place, below or above, you're not feeling safe. So you're either fight or flight and ramped up, or underactive and frozen. But in the underactive zone, it also makes sense that you could do practices that would, you know, help get you more engaged with the world, like connecting with people who are safe and putting one foot in front of the other in those kind of ways, rather than just like doing the calming, grounding practices.
Right. Yeah. So let me ask you, so viewing those things in terms of the vagus nerve, is that well supported by science? Because sometimes, yeah. I'm not you know, intimately familiar with polyvagal theory. I know enough to have this conversation, but I do see a lot of kind of self-described people on social media talk about stimulating the vagus nerve, right? And they attribute a lot of things to vagal nerve stimulation. And I know that there are like devices that you can surgically implant that stimulate the vagus nerve for certain things, but are we in danger of over interpreting the data, or like making some assumptions that aren't well founded by science with respect to the vagus nerve?
You know what humans do. They take this stuff and take it and stretch it in every direction possible and make parades and festivals and cults and clubs and everything else out of it. And more science to back it, to argue it, to refute it, I think what you and I try really hard to do is sift through that evidence. But to answer your question, like the vagus nerve is fascinating, first of all. Like I remember in med school learning about it as the information superhighway of the body, because it's this nerve. The term vagus means wandering, and it wanders through the body and passes through so many different organ systems that it really does have the ability to, which is needed for our survival and makes evolutionary sense, but has the ability to bring all these systems on board in a way that's needed for that response, that survival response. But yes, there is conflicting evidence. And I think if you get caught up too in the literal interpretations of things, you'll find yourself in the weeds of some very tricky neuroscience. But I think it's a great and useful framework in therapy, you know, as a simple answer to your question.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I remember recently seeing, this isn't about the vagus nerve, but seeing this video that's been going around social media of this guy who's like one of those hustlers, hard chargers, and he talks about his morning routine and how he's going, as he said, he's going to over dopamine, like using the pharmacy of the body, we're going to over dopamine the mind by my morning reverie and the 10 minute walk on the treadmill. I'm doing a meditation with my wife, and I'm like, the pharmacy of the body, buddy, over dopamine the mind. Like,
yeah,
people will take these principles from science and then they'll use it to, you know, simplify, oversimplify and sell a product or explain something. Anyway.
Yeah, there has been this explosion of content and coaching and I don't know, like ideas that are useful and less useful on how to approach trauma out there, for sure. It's all over my Instagram feed anyway.
Yeah.
But there's this, on the vagus nerve topic, there's this interesting thing called the vagal paradox. Not the vagus paradox.
There are plenty of paradoxes for Las Vegas.
That would conjure up a different kind of nervous system response to think about the vagus paradox. But the vagal paradox, just positing this question of like, how can something like the vagal nerve be a marker of both resilience and the cause of our stuckness and trauma-related symptoms, you know. But it's because this is part of the system and machinery, especially one outside of the actual brain, that's out there sending, receiving, transmitting information that's needed for this thing that polyvagal theory calls neuroception, where we're always scanning our environment for safety versus danger. And we have ways of responding to that, like fight or flight or freeze. What do they call the freeze? It's like the possum response, or curled up, playing dead, perhaps. That doesn't get as much attention as the dramatic protector responses sometimes, but is a really important one to keep in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So you've got something that when it's overactivated serves one purpose, and underactivated serves another, or at least we can attribute different kinds of problems we struggle with to different levels of activation in this one system, this one giant nerve.
Yeah. Early in my research career, this is like right out of residency, I was working at the University of Utah doing psychiatry studies. And one of the early studies I was involved in was a vagal nerve stimulator study for treatment-resistant depression, where we'd have our surgeon colleagues kind of implant this device just beneath the skin that hooks to the vagal nerve and delivers an electrical pulse at a certain frequency to bring it back to this tone that was associated from all these studies. This all got through the FDA and has been an available treatment, even though it's not used much. But it was really interesting because you know, people would come in and they'd have this other device that queries their device and how it's been doing, and they can feel it when it turns on and when it's active, or you can almost learn to pick it up in their vocal cords a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, it was fascinating.
What's their sort of self-reported experience of having it activated?
Yeah, it's like depression's tricky to characterize moment to moment, right? Because it's more of this phenomenon of how has your mood been over the past days and weeks. But you know, from the studies, like the direct experience that we had with it there, and then the data from all the studies before and after that, you know, it was really, you know, a positive thing when all else has failed for, you know, a significant percentage of people compared to placebo, but a very invasive one, and also not very dramatic for them to feel. It's not like you turn it on and you feel better. It's not like a ketamine, non-ordinary state of consciousness at all, but a modulation. But it was a modulation that's still impressive that science got to the place where we could do that relatively safely and with some efficacy.
Yeah.
You know, it's wild.
It's interesting. It makes me wonder about the downstream effects of vagal nerve stimulation that we don't quite understand yet.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Because it is wandering through like these areas by your heart, from brainstem, heart, lungs, gallbladder, pancreas, digestive system, like, in a rapid way to bring those relevant changes on board that the nervous system needs, like slow down digestion, increase blood flow to muscles, but not to these other areas.
Yeah.
And, you know, heart starts beating, respirations, deep and speed up, but and then in a different direction at the other edge of your window or along the spectrum towards hypoarousal.
Yeah, man. Fascinating. So, excuse me.
Bless you.
Anything else to say about polyvagal theory before we move on to something
else?
You know,
maybe to try and break it down a little more simply even is it's about how our nervous system, specifically our autonomic nervous system, responds to things we encounter in day-to-day life through three specific pathways. The fight or flight is the sympathetic nervous system. We probably all remember that from early physiology classes and everything else. But then the middle zone, the window of tolerance, would be called your ventral vagal or where you're safe and social would be an easy way to summarize it. Sympathetic, fight or flight. And then on the low end of that window would be your dorsal vagal, or your immobilized. So it's these three different types of nervous system response. And polyvagal theory is based on this idea of hierarchy. Like if you have feelings of safety, you cannot have, and this is an overgeneralization, but you cannot have an overall sense of threat if you're feeling safe, right? So there is a hierarchy, and this starts to get into why safe relationships and safe settings are so important for trauma work that we can talk about. And then, but that's the gist of it. And each response is automatic, hence the name, kind of autonomic nervous system, and subconscious. And then the last concept of it that's worth really highlighting is co-regulation as a part of this, that, you know, stems back. Look at when we're babies, we really need the presence of a caregiver to survive. And it means a lot in trauma work, right? We're wounded in relationship, and we heal in relationship for so many kinds of trauma.
Yeah. Maybe that's an interesting rabbit hole to go down then. This idea of co-regulation, especially being important when we're young. And then you said, you know, autonomic, automatic, subconscious. A lot of, I think, what makes dealing with trauma, healing from trauma, living with trauma difficult for people is how outside of their perceived ability to control it is, like I was referencing earlier with, you know, this light switch versus the fuse. And so we have a lot of different treatments that are designed to try to help people at that level. Don't want to get too well. We probably have some more things we want to talk about with respect to what trauma is before we get to treatments. But
on the co-regulation front, that's another paradox I find really important, is that the path to healing many types of these traumas, especially the interpersonal type, is through doing it in a safe container of a safe relationship. But because of the trauma, those things do not feel safe.
Right.
And there is a sense of mistrust. So that's why, you know, I think you and I both have this huge amount of kind of empathy, compassion, respect for those going through this work, because it's not easy to do that. And the whole idea of the support of other, it can be the most powerful healing force, or it can also be re-traumatizing and or reinforcing of patterns. And you don't have control over the other person entirely.
Yeah. It takes such an act of courage, because, you know, like you just got done talking about, a lot of what we do when we're traumatized is try to protect ourselves from being harmed again, being exposed to harm. And it is those efforts to protect ourselves that often lead to our self-defeating symptoms, if you want to call them that. So it's a little paradoxical in that, you know, in order to, you said, you know, wounded in relationship, heal in relationship, in order to heal from trauma, at least one perspective is I need to be able to trust, let's say a therapist or a group or whatever, enough that I'm willing to be vulnerable. And so that once I'm vulnerable, I can achieve some kind of intimacy and have that pay off. So I'm teaching my central nervous system, teaching my subconscious mind and the conscious manifestations in the forms of emotions and cognitions, that it's okay. It's okay for me to trust certain people, that my vulnerability and by extension, my intimacy will be reciprocated. I'll be well cared for. And that can take a lot of reps and requires a lot of trust. And so, yes, we have a ton of compassion for those people who are traumatized who, you know, certainly don't want to trust because they could be harmed again. So it is paradoxical, and I think if it doesn't, hopefully it will evoke compassion from, you know, if you have family members who are traumatized, or if you're dealing with clients who might be frustrating to work with because of the treatment resistant nature of their trauma.
And we're biased, right? As clinicians, therapists offering kind of psychotherapy routes for healing from trauma, and kind of medication assisted and, mm-hmm. and medication, psychotherapy only and all that. But there is something to be said about the role of a good therapist in healing from trauma, because we do need to do some of this healing work in relationship, right? And right. because everyone has their own triggers they bring, including therapists, right? This is a big thing we work with a lot of therapists in training on. But a therapist in the right kind of trauma therapy should be providing those cues of safety, like active listening, open body posture, you know, that soft gaze, validating your distress, inviting you back into that ventral vagal state of safe and social and self-regulated and all that. And that is what you could also call a corrective experience. And yes, you can have that and need to have that in so many different ways and relationships in life, but to really start to the healing road back from trauma is sometimes slow and I mean often needs a lot of you know, careful and patient initial steps to maintain that and reclaim that sense of safety, and then kind of work from there on expanding your window and how to get back in the window and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also not a straight line, right? Yeah. Not only is it slow, but it's up and down and back and forward. It's definitely a squiggly line. And it's one of those things where you can feel like you're getting quote unquote worse before you get better, because you're asking these protectors to take a minute to, like, you know, relax, maybe assume new roles like you described from this IFS perspective, and really step into very uncomfortable zones. And again, we're not taking you all the way outside of your window of tolerance or your comfort zone barriers, but enough that you can get these corrective experiences where you can, you know, feel safe going to the grocery store, knowing that it's not going to be perilous.
Because, you know, we also know from the, like, polyvagal theory and so many other ways of looking at this, that learning doesn't happen very well outside of your window of tolerance. Like, when systems are diverted to survival mechanisms of fight, flight, or freeze, that's not conducive to productive learning. So the need to slow the pace in healing from trauma, you know, especially when you're coming from a place of overwhelm, by definition, is paramount. And like, if the trauma comes in overwhelm, then the healing needs to be different, like slow and safe.
Yeah. Slow and safe. It makes me think, you know, when I was in the military, we got trained in prolonged exposure therapy for PTSD and also cognitive processing therapy. And these are two therapies that in the outcome literature have probably received the bulk of the attention mm-hmm. from a research perspective, and they have decent support, you know, decent data. Man, there's a lot of, especially with prolonged exposure. So that is, you know, you pick your index trauma and you have them write a narrative and maybe even record themselves telling the story.
Yeah.
And you have them tell the story over and over and over again in the context of this therapeutic relationship that you described, with the idea being that as they expose themselves to the memory, you know, titrated, mm-hmm. that they'll habituate to it enough that they can then process some of the stuck points, some of the cognitive distortions that are associated with it. And then cognitive processing therapy, kind of similar, with less of an emphasis on exposure and more an emphasis on, you know, processing the changes and the meaning making that they do as a result of being exposed to the trauma. But there's a ton of dropout. Like, the dropout for prolonged exposure is really, really high because it's so hard. I mean, just hearing me describe it, if any of you are not familiar with prolonged exposure, you could probably be like, oh man, I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah, because you do have to, like, the work involves staying within the window of tolerance, but gently pushing the limits of that window. And, like, you know, it becomes another paradox, like, but you a paradox being that you do need to push yourself into those uncomfortable places, but not too fast to get more traumatized or dysregulated where the work can't occur, because the, like, slowness and safety is the rhythm of this, like, this nervous system state that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's something to keep in mind, even in the MAPS MDMA assisted therapy work for PTSD, tied to those dosing sessions is 40 hours of therapy, right? That's right. A lot of work.
I think it's important to point out, and I'm glad you brought up MAPS, because, you know, we like to, people get really excited about those, that phase three data. And I think the excitement is warranted.
Yeah.
Given that, I put it down here in my notes that of the phase three data participants, 67% of them no longer met diagnostic criteria for PTSD versus 32% of the placebo. And then if you expand that to people who had a clinically meaningful response, so these are including some people who maybe didn't no longer meet the diagnostic criteria.
Response versus remission, essentially.
Right, yeah. 88%. And if you compare that to the prolonged exposure in the CPT data, you know, prolonged exposure, 55% or so people experiencing remission by participating in that treatment, 46% for CPT. So the stats are promising.
So, finish your thought. I have a question for you on it.
I just wanted to sort of underscore what you said. Like, it's not just the medicine. And yeah, we have a lot of fun mm-hmm. ideas about what the medicine is doing that enables people to approach their trauma in ways yeah. that are hard.
It's cool medicine.
But it's all this therapy too that's going on. I mean, plenty of people in the non-medicine placebo group got better too.
Yeah. And what I was going to ask is just what the people look like, if you know, going into those therapies that you were pointing out as potential comparisons, like non-medicine approaches, because what struck me about the MAPS data is the severity of the PTSD, the chronic PTSD of most of the participants going in, with an average of like 7 to 10 years of PTSD and essentially treatment resistant, you could call it.
Yeah. So the data I was referencing were from a study of veterans. So I didn't read it deeply enough to know if they were treatment resistant, so-called, specifically. Yeah. But you know, when you look at a veteran population getting treatment in a VA, most of these people have received polypharmacy. Like, they've had a lot of different medicines that have been tossed at them. They've had a lot yeah. of different therapies.
Yeah. But I guess to summarize that point on the slowness and the container of therapy needed, it also speaks to the need to really work on yourself. If you're a clinician, therapist, or anyone working in trauma, really working on your own calm sense of a calming presence and attunement to the other, and what you bring to that interaction is so key yeah. to the equation in helping someone make progress in their healing work. Yeah.
So I'll be transparent about the three things that help me do that as a therapist. So one is confidence in my treatment modality.
Yeah.
If I feel like this isn't going to work, or it doesn't work for a lot of people, then it's hard for me to be yeah. present with somebody who's just suffering a lot.
You can't take them to the depths of hell of like revisiting a trauma without that confidence that you can like guide them by the hand back out of that pit, right?
Yeah, because like you said earlier, I don't want to re-traumatize them. I don't want to hurt them. I don't want this to be arbitrary. So yeah, confidence in my treatment modality. The other is my own tolerance of distressing emotions in others. Mm-hmm. You know, our people-pleasing episode got a lot of downloads, and part of my sort of journey as a recovering people pleaser is letting people have their distressing emotions without feeling like I needed to like make them feel quote unquote better so that I could feel better. Mm-hmm. So yeah, getting better at that, getting better at letting yeah. people be distressed in my presence.
Yeah. And the psychedelic therapy work has helped us with that, like getting out of the way of the inner healing intelligence, and the fact that you're just recognizing that the healing work does happen from within. And these other things we're talking about, like the therapeutic relationship, the safe container, are key ingredients, but it's really done in the individual. Yeah.
And so my third thing is just self-care. Just yeah. making sure that I don't take on too many clients with very serious trauma. Because even as good as I am about drawing those boundaries, I'm a human being with compassion. Mm-hmm. It seeps yeah. in, right? So, making sure I don't take on too many clients with very, very serious trauma, and then just, yeah, caring for myself, making sure I'm doing the things that make Steve Thayer feel good, and feel healthy. And it's a little ironic by the fact that I'm sick right now and I'm still recording the podcast, but
yeah,
I feel like this was in alignment. I do feel pretty good in spite of the way my voice sounds.
We should have brought the podcast to you in your sick bed.
Yeah. With my chicken noodle soup.
Yeah. No, those are great. Those are great. And someone asked me a question earlier today, and maybe I'll pass on to you to get your thoughts. As I was visiting with someone in research clinic, and they were just reporting how they'd felt activated in a certain way today, and asking, what are your tools, your favorite tools for calming your nervous system?
Yeah. Whiskey. Mm-hmm. No, it's actually not a bad tool, but like personally, or would this be?
Yeah. I mean, I'll ask it personally because there are many, and it's really an individual question. You got to try on the things and see what works for you.
Right? Yeah. physical exercise is huge for me. You know, to the extent that I get in the habit, cold plunges are really good for me to sort of regulate my nervous system. I got one of those cheap ones on Amazon, and you just fill with shower water and jump in.
I did some of that this morning on daylight savings time.
So, and if
the
I can,
sun came up,
if I can combine exercise with being outdoors, like getting away from the screens, getting away from, you know, the hustle and bustle of suburban life and get up into the mountains, that's really big for me.
Oh,
and then connecting with loved ones, especially loved ones with whom I have a great reciprocal relationship, right? This isn't somebody who's just, the entire conversation is going to be about them needing me to do something for them. Which I have very little of those, if really hardly any, but, yeah, I mean, those are really important. Eating a good meal, and by good, I don't mean an entire chocolate cake, although, you know, I'm not knocking that either, but, eating nutritious food, and then, music.
Yeah.
So listening to music, but also singing in the car by myself, or, you know, we've joked around about me playing the flute, but I just got a new bamboo flute on Etsy.
Nice.
And I love playing that thing, man. I mean, as much of an amateur as I am, it's a lot of fun, and it just makes me happy and calms me down.
You're getting good at that thing.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. No. Cool. Thanks for sharing. Because I think that's how we're learning about approaches from each other and from all this content we were talking about. But really, all this stuff we're talking about in trauma is a practice, and you have to try it on, and you also need to practice enough so it's a real tool you can leverage out there in the real world when all bets are off and triggers fly at you and things are really put to the test. But it's nice to have some tried and tested practices, even if it's like taking 5 deep breaths or whatever you need. And in some treatment centers and environments I've worked in, there were approaches like, oh, here's an old phone book, tear up the pages. Here's some ice for you to throw or a pillow to yell into. And then there's the work of Peter Levine in Waking the Tiger and other books on somatic experiencing that talks about how animals after an event will go out, animals in the wild will go just shake it off. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can see why people go to ecstatic dance or just go bust a move in their room or sing in the car or go on a run or punch a punching bag. But I've been really paying attention to how, you know, that tightness we're talking about in the body that comes from trauma, stress, and other wounds. Really, like, the mind follows suit in some ways. And if you can relax that, there is a relaxation of the emotions and mental structures as well, I've found.
Yeah. So I know we got to wrap up here in a second, but there are other treatment approaches out there we didn't do a deep dive on, like EMDR and other psychedelics. You know, there's some growing evidence that ketamine-assisted therapy can be really well suited for certain kinds of trauma. You know, perhaps a fledgling research on psilocybin and other psychedelics. Certainly we're excited about the MDMA data and what that could mean about future treatments. But, you know, trauma affects us as a global population significantly. Not everything that happens to us that is distressing is necessarily traumatic. I think you brought up a stat before we hit record that, you know, it's actually a small minority of people who are exposed to a traumatic event that go on to develop the condition that we call PTSD. We didn't talk necessarily about developmental trauma or complex PTSD versus, you know, single event PTSD, but
Well, this is a topic we've talked about before, and we'll need to do again because there's so many, like the inherited suffering and
generational trauma,
intergenerational trauma, ancestral burdens. Some people call it to talk about and all the different, like we mentioned briefly, somatic experiencing, and like there are tools in there, like one called pendulation that helps mm-hmm. you swing like a pendulum towards the discomfort or traumatic event and back to that soothing place to practice what that feels like. And EMDR, I know we've covered here before and would encourage people to go look at, but we'll have to revisit this topic from a few more of these angles.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Reed.
Yeah. Feel better, Steve.
That's my plan. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.